From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It was always part of the Soviet Communist Party's job to keep secrets. Now some of those secrets are being revealed. The archives of the Soviet Communist Party have been opened. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with William Taubman, one of the first American scholars to take advantage of this new access. He'll also share his impressions of life in Moscow today. Also today, Studs Terkel. He's best known for recording the stories of other people's lives. Coming up, he shares some of his own story. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie, White Men Can't Jump. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Libya has warned the West that its economic interests in the country could suffer if sanctions are imposed. An air and military embargo is set to go into effect in less than 2 weeks' time unless Libya hands over two men suspected of bombing Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland in 1988. Al Fermita reports.
Extra troops have been posted around Western embassies in Tripoli following yesterday's violent protests in which the Venezuelan mission was burnt out. Libya has apologized to Venezuela, and the country's leader, Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, has again told his people to exercise restraint. But Libya has also issued veiled threats to the West. It warned diplomats in Tripoli that Western interests in the country could suffer if sanctions went ahead. In a sermon broadcast live on Libyan television, a religious leader said the lives of foreign diplomats were in danger, and he called on the authorities to expel them. European diplomats in Tripoli met today to discuss the worsening situation. Westerners are not yet rushing to leave, but European countries are considering plans to evacuate their nationals if there is more trouble. For National Public Radio, this is Al Hamida in Tunis.
There was heavy fighting reported today in Croatia, just as the United Nations prepared to deploy a peacekeeping force in the former Yugoslav Republic. Hospital officials in the northeastern Croatian town of Osijek said that 12 people were killed and 28 injured in a Serbian attack. Police in a nearby Croatian town reported an attack in which 5 people were killed. There were also reports of fighting between Serbs and other ethnic groups in neighboring Bosnia. Bosnia's president appealed for a ceasefire and peacekeeping troops after ethnic Serbs took over the second town in 2 days. The UN is planning to set up its headquarters in Sarajevo, but there are no plans to deploy peacekeepers in Bosnia. Democratic presidential candidate Bill Clinton defended his civil rights record during an appearance in Buffalo, New York today. Clinton was reacting to a campaign ad from his rival, Jerry Brown, that criticizes the Arkansas governor for not having a civil rights law in his home state. From member station WBFO, Mark Scott reports.
Clinton called Brown's ad an outrage, saying he lobbied aggressively for a civil rights bill, but that it died in the Arkansas legislature. Speaking before a largely student audience at Canisius College in Buffalo, Clinton also accused Brown of pandering for black votes.
And you know, my opponent, Governor Brown, the other day, in an attempt to get African-American voters in New York to vote for him, I think, said it committed to put Jesse Jackson on the ticket with it. I think that we should not give anybody the impression that we're making decisions solely for political reasons in the election season.
New Yorkers will vote next Tuesday to select their choice for a Democratic presidential nominee. For National Public Radio, I'm Mark Scott in Buffalo.
This is National Public Radio News from Washington. Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street, with blue chip issues gaining. Analysts said that the broader market remained down, responding to the release of weak employment figures for March. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 15 points to end the day at 3,249. Declines led advances by a margin of 3-1 in heavy trading. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was about 188 million shares. In response to calls for a tightening of economic sanctions against Haiti, the U.S. Treasury Department this week seized an oil tanker suspected of recently delivering fuel to the Caribbean country. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
A Belize-flagged oil tanker was seized Tuesday in San Juan, Puerto Rico by U.S. Customs officials. They charged the vessel was used to break economic sanctions against Haiti by the Organization of American States, or OAS. Treasury Department officials said the tanker picked up 250,000 gallons of diesel fuel from New York. But instead of shipping the oil to the Dominican Republic, The destination listed in the ship's manifest, the cargo was instead delivered to Haiti's capital of Port-au-Prince. Last October, the United States and other members of the OAS imposed sanctions against Haiti's military-backed government. The sanctions were aimed at forcing the regime to accept an OAS plan to restore exiled Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide to power. However, the OAS plan has been deadlocked for more than a month, and OAS diplomats say their economic sanctions against Haiti are being violated by several countries. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
Japan's trade surplus with the rest of the world hit a new monthly record in February, climbing to $10.8 billion. Officials said the current recession in Japan was cutting back on imports and forcing Japanese manufacturers to export more goods. Japan's growing trade surplus is a source of conflict with its trading partners, including the United States and the European Community. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Who would have thought we'd have access to the files of the Soviet Communist Party? Well, as of February, the archives of the Central Committee of the Communist Party are open. It's a goldmine for historians. My guest, William Taubman, was one of the first American scholars to take advantage of this access. He's writing a biography of former Prime Minister Nikita Khrushchev. He's also working with officials at the archives on designing its future use. Taubman is a professor of political science at Amherst College. He's been to Russia several times in the past year. His most recent trip was in March. Before he shares his impressions of life in Moscow today, let's find out what it felt like to be in the archives.
It was a thrill. It felt as if it was a miracle. I not only was in at the headquarters of the former Central Committee of the party, which is where the archives were located, I was not only in their reading room, but they took me into the vaults where the actual documents are located. They took me behind the scenes and showed me card files that they had as a kind of guide to the materials in the vaults. So in that sense, it was a tremendous thrill. And when I actually got the documents in my hand, or I was reading them on microfilm to see, for example, the protocols of a meeting of the party secretariat or of the party Politburo, to see Stalin's signature scrawled across a page or Khrushchev's signature, it was a real charge.
Now, why exactly were you invited in on this? It seems to me that the Russians might have wanted to examine these documents and ferret some out before letting anyone in the West read them.
Well, I think they're torn because on the one hand, you're right. They want to know what they have. They want to put them in order. They want to ration them out in return for various favors they may receive from the West. But on the other hand, despite the lavishness of the facilities, they're poor. The archives are a kind of microcosm of the whole country at this point, which contains these immense natural riches, but is dirt poor when it comes to hard currency. And so these archives are very anxious to begin arrangements with the West, which will bring them publicity, which will bring them goodwill, and will also bring them directly or indirectly money.
Well, you think people will be paying for access?
Well, not in so many words. What happens, for example, my mission in the Central Committee Archives was to help to organize a conference on the history of the Cold War. The American partner would be the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, and the Russian partner would be these very same Central Committee Archives. And the archives, as our partner, would stage the conference. They would provide the hall, they would provide the translation, they would declassify the documents, they would Xerox the documents, they would write some of the papers. And in return for absolutely legitimate services like this, there would be some compensation for them. And this is a very small arrangement. The papers have had stories here. I'm not really conversant with the details about huge deals in which millions of dollars are supposedly going to be paid to these archives for the right to microfilm their holdings. The Hoover Institution in California has supposedly signed an agreement like this with the Central Committee Archive.
So what are some of the most interesting documents you've found so far?
Well, I should say this, that I talked about what a thrill it is, what a miracle it is, but there's a downside to it as well. It turns out that not all the most interesting documents, and in fact, for my purposes as a biographer of Khrushchev, the most important documents, it turns out, are not there. They remain behind the walls of the Kremlin in the so-called presidential archive, whose materials have not been transferred to the archive I was in. And there, for example, the records of the Politburo of the party after 53, they're still there. The personal files of the most important personal papers, which include politically important materials of Stalin, Khrushchev, Brezhnev, are still there. So that's the first problem. The second problem is that even the marvelous materials that the archive does have, they've not all been declassified. It's not clear to me how many have been declassified. I think a fair number have. But you can still, you know, you go, the procedure is you look through the finding aids, you find the documents that interest you, you request them, and then they're either delivered to you or you're told that they're not available yet because they haven't been declassified. And I was told that about a number of them. So there are obstacles, and by the time the day is done, although you're in this magical place, you're still wishing that you had more.
That said, what are some of the documents that you found that were of great interest?
Well, the kinds of things, I tried to make a random sampling. So, for example, I ordered one day's protocols of the Secretariat of the Communist Party in the Central Committee Archive. And I was stunned to discover that this group of seven or eight top party leaders in one day decided upwards of 100 issues. And to see whether this was also true of the Politburo, I went over to the other party archive, the Central Party Archive, and ordered a day's worth of decisions of the Politburo from 1934. And here, they decided, on this one day, they decided 120 questions. You don't get, I hasten to add, the byplay, the dialogue. It doesn't say Stalin said so-and-so objected. You simply get a list of the topics considered and the decisions taken. And it comes to that kind of incredible number.
That would indicate to me that there wasn't a lot of freewheeling debate about each of these subjects.
To say the least. Well, I asked people I know, both in the archives and out, about this. What could explain this? How did they operate? And the answer was everything, or almost everything, was coordinated in advance. When an issue came up, it was given to the party leader in charge, whose job it was to prepare a decision. He then consulted with the relevant departments of the Central Committee and other government agencies and brought to the Politburo or the Secretariat a decision already made or already proposed. There was no sign of various options, you know, we can do this or we can do that, no sign of argument. And then I said, well, that's fine, but in a system, the leader of which is Joseph Stalin, surely the people who were preparing the decision wanted to know what he would think, lest they arrived at a Politburo meeting with a finalized decision only to be told he didn't like it. And they said, well, people knew pretty much what he wanted. That was one of the things that a good colleague of his or a bureaucrat had to know, because the cost of not knowing was conceivably as much as a bullet in the back of the head.
What else have you found there that is important to you?
Well, another thing I looked at was a file of documents that crossed Khrushchev's desk. I wanted to see what kinds of documents crossed his desk on an average day. And they had documents in this file from a particular, or list of documents from particular 2 months in 1954-55. And again, I was really surprised to see how many of them there were. There would be 20, 30, or 40 items which would hit his desk through this one channel. I assume there were other channels on any particular day. And in addition to the number of them, I was surprised to see how trivial many of them were. I remember one in which some elderly party member asked permission to attend classes at the higher party school. And he said in his petition that if this weren't convenient, then he would be willing to take this course as a correspondence course. One would think that an item like this could have been decided much farther down the hierarchy and didn't require the time of the leader of the USSR. But there it was on his desk, and his signature was scrawled across the document saying that he approved. I think, you know, this is not an earthshake. The item itself isn't earthshaking, but the revelation that the leaders of the Soviet Union spent so much time on trivia helps to understand why they made a mess in the end of what was really important.
What do you think is the problem? Do you think the leaders of the Soviet Union didn't know how to delegate?
Well, I think that's partly it. These are people who wanted to decide everything themselves, but it's certainly not just personality. It has to do with the nature of a political system, which is, in effect, one mammoth bureaucratic organization. Everybody in the country works for the state and the party. Everybody in the country is subordinate, in the end, to the same small group of party leaders or even the individual party leader. And in that kind of situation, the buck is passed up, as it is in any bureaucracy. But since the whole country is one huge bureaucracy, more bucks are passed at a faster pace.
If you're just joining us, my guest is William Taubman, professor of political science at Amherst College. He's also researching a biography of Khrushchev. And he is one of the few Americans who has so far taken advantage of the new access to the archives of the Central Committee of the Communist Party. He was last in the Soviet Union in March. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Soviet expert William Taubman is my guest. Do you kind of feel like you really ought to hurry up and take advantage of these open archives because maybe they won't be open for long?
Well, I do feel that. But on the other hand, I was there long enough to sort of case the joint and to discover, as I mentioned, that the most important materials for me are not yet available.
Right.
I think that somebody who was, let us say, working on a somewhat different subject, if I were working on a subject of how the Central Committee of the Party, through its various departments, controlled all aspects of Soviet life, then I would be in Moscow right now. Because, for example, as I read through the files of the Culture Department of the Central Committee, I came across reflections of the Pasternak affair. I didn't actually read the documents. I read the index to the documents, but it talked about how instructions had been sent to the Writers' Union for how to handle the awarding of the Nobel Prize to the poet Boris Pasternak. So that, in other words, somebody with a topic like that, somebody who's interested in the day-to-day control by the party of cultural life, of social life, of all aspects of Soviet life, should be on the plane right now, even though, as I also said earlier, there's no guarantee that those documents that I saw in the index will have already been declassified.
You know, historically in the Soviet Union, one of the problems has been revisionism, historical revisionism, and amnesia. When the leadership would change, the past would be rewritten, certain things would be officially forgotten. How much revisionism do you see happening now? How much amnesia do you see happening now with the collapse of the Soviet Union?
Well, two or three years ago, when Gorbachev was still in power, the history of the Soviet Union was the rage. That is to say, the newspapers and journals were filled with revisions of Soviet history based at that point not on access to documents, but simply reflecting the fact that people who had long memories could at last speak and write. Nowadays, interestingly enough, not that many people are consumed with history in the way they were two or three years ago. And I think the reason is partly the fact that the problems they face are so compelling day to day that they have no time and no energy and also no money. That is, many of the historians, like other smart people in the former Soviet Union, are trying to find themselves a place in a free market. They're looking around for jobs that will pay them more money than a slot as a historian for an institute. If you sit all day in the archive doing research for a book of history, You won't get paid very much, and the further fact is the book isn't even likely to be published because the publishers want these days to publish only bestsellers, and it turns out that the bestsellers are detective stories, mysteries of various kinds, romances, and pornography.
This sounds familiar.
So in that, in a very real sense, the tyranny of the state is being replaced for the moment by the tyranny of the market, even though, of course, in the long run, the hope is the market will open the way to freedom.
You were last in Russia just a couple of weeks ago. What's different now, just walking down the streets, walking into shops, now that it's not a communist society anymore? What are the visible signs of difference that you see?
Well, when I was there in January, I was there the day they raised prices, or they allowed prices to rise as part of the economic reforms they're carrying out. The prices went up, but at that point there was little, if anything, to buy in the stores. Food stores were empty. You'd see these row shelves upon shelves and nothing in them. It was like a morgue, as one of my Russian friends said. This time, there were products in the stores. There was milk, there was cottage cheese, there were vegetables, there were some fruits, there was even an occasional scrawny chicken. There was some meat. But the prices are extraordinarily high. Now, that's, in a way, the theory. The high prices were supposed to produce the goods. People who'd been hoarding, factories, processing plants that had been hoarding, were supposed to now deliver to the market in order to sell their goods at higher prices. But I asked myself the question, what for Russians who couldn't afford what was in the stores, and this is, I think, the majority of the population, what was worse, to enter a store and find nothing, or to enter a store and find it full, but with things that you can't afford to buy? The reforms are impoverishing people. I heard on Soviet or Russian television when I was there the following figure, that the poverty level for a family of four is now considered to be below an income of 1,500 rubles a month. And the average wage in the country is about 850 rubles a month. An average pension is about 400 rubles a month. The result of all of this is that something like 80 to 90% of the population lives below the poverty line. This is what strikes you. And it strikes you, I think, even more when you walk down the streets. And in several places in Moscow, as you walk for blocks, you walk between two long lines of people who are standing there on either side. It's like a column. You walk between them. And they're standing there silently, holding out their hands, trying to sell things. When the people are young and what they're trying to sell is some glitzy Western product, you have a feeling that there's energy in the air, that energy's begun flowing, and that people have come out of their houses to start trying to buy and sell, and that this is a good sign. But the bulk of these people are old people, and they're dressed in threadbare clothes, and they have hangdog looks on their face, and what they're holding out to sell is the one item of value that they've managed to collect in their entire life. You know, a crystal goblet, or a pair of shoes. And you have this terrible, sad feeling that they're not going to sell it. They're going to come back tomorrow. It's going to go on and on. And someday, although one is told there's no starvation, some sad day they're going to starve or they're going to die. The point is that although these economic reforms that they're carrying out may make sense, and the IMF obviously thinks they do, and the West obviously thinks they do, they may make economic sense, but politically and socially they are explosive, they are destructive, and they are creating a constituency against not only the market, but also against democracy. And that constituency includes, I discovered to my horror, not only the Neanderthal right, the former Soviet patriots and the anti-Semitic Russian extremists, but good people, progressive, liberal, democratic people are equally appalled.
There is now a proposed aid package for the Soviet Union. Seven nations, including the United States, would be giving $24 billion in aid to the former Soviet republics, the bulk of the money going to Russia. Over $4 billion would be coming from the United States. Do you think that this aid package would help the kind of poverty that you're describing in Russia?
Well, I hope it will help. I think if the money gets channeled to the people in need, it will help. There's been a lot of talk in the West about how the money goes astray, but that doesn't even seem to me to be the main problem. The main problem is that I think no amount of money, even big money on this scale, can solve their problem. No amount of money can turn people who believe in their bones that buying and selling is somehow corrupt, can turn them into believers in a free market. And even the generosity of the West, which is clearly on display here, has another side to it in the eyes of Russian beholders. These are people who are desperate, and they are dependent on us. And with that desperation and dependence comes a kind of touchy defensiveness. There is a latent anti-Westernism, certainly on the part of former communist bureaucrats and Russia firsters, and it comes out at the thought that the West is helping them. Oddly enough, I felt this in the archives when I pushed them in my negotiations in the archives to declassify more and better materials and to do it faster. They would get very heated up about the fact that our partnership with them gave us no right to put the pressure on them in this way.
You were describing before about how there are these lines of people selling things in the streets. In Russia, did you buy anything on this last trip to Russia?
I didn't buy much, partly because I'm generally not a buyer, but also because I was too busy running from one archive to another. The one thing I did buy was I bought two of these political matryoshkas. You know, the non-political matryoshka is the wooden doll of the old the grandmother, their old peasant grandmother, and it opens up, and there's another one inside, and that opens up, and there's another one.
Yeah.
They now sell them with the big doll is Yeltsin. He opens up, and there's Gorbo, and then he opens up, and on you go. Not only all the way to Lenin, which is what I expected, but the tiniest doll of all is Nicholas II, the last Tsar. So the dolls begin and end with the leaders of Russia, and all the leaders of the Soviet Union turn out to be has-beens inside.
Well, William Taubman, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're most welcome.
William Taubman is a professor of political science at Amherst College. We recorded our interview yesterday. In the interim, there's been some reshuffling in the Russian government. Yegor Gaidar, the chief architect of the free market reforms, will no longer be finance minister. He will continue as deputy prime minister in charge of overall economic policy. Taubman told us today how he interprets this news. Although the Russian economic policy is winning approval in the international economic community, it's losing steam at home. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we turn the tables on Studs Terkel. He's best known for his oral histories. Now it's his turn to tell us about how he survived the Depression, what he did during World War II, and his work from law student to soap opera actor and, of course, interviewer. Studs Terkel has a new book of oral histories. The subject is race. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews White Men Can't Jump, the new basketball film starring Wesley Snipes, Woody Harrelson, and Rosie Perez. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Miami, the drug trafficking trial of former Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega has gone to the jury. However, the jury will not start its deliberations until tomorrow morning. The judge completed his instruction shortly before 5:30 p.m., and then the jury was sequestered for the night. The last of the four Los Angeles police officers on trial on charges of using excessive force took the stand today. His testimony could prove harmful to the other defendants, as he testified that his fellow officers were out of control. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
Theodore Briseño told the court that defendant Lawrence Powell's repeated baton strikes to Rodney King were unjustified.
I didn't understand what was going on out there. I just didn't understand it. It didn't make any sense to me. I couldn't see why they were doing what they were doing.
What did you perceive regarding the conduct of the baton strokes?
I thought the whole thing was just out of control.
Well, did you think it was right or wrong or what?
Wrong.
Briseño, like the other defendants, is accused of using excessive force, but unlike the others, he is accused of a single improper act, a kick to Rodney King's head near the end of the incident. But the defendant told the jury that he was not kicking King at all, but was putting his foot on his shoulder to get King to stop moving so that the other officers would stop beating him. At the Simi Valley Courthouse, this is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
In Yugoslavia, the president of Bosnia has called on the UN to deploy military observers to the region in order to help prevent a full-scale civil war. Pierre Vicker reports that as many as 50 people are believed to have been killed in the last 24 hours in battles between ethnic factions.
The appeal by President Izetbegovic followed the most violent day of fighting in Bosnia since the Republic declared its independence from Yugoslavia. Eyewitnesses said the heaviest bombardment was in the border town of Bjelina, with as many as 50 people reported killed during running street battles between the Serbian-led Yugoslav army and Muslim militias. Fighting was also reported in other regions of the Republic as Yugoslav army units attacked strategic targets with heavy artillery and tanks. Croatian state television claimed a major federal infantry offensive near the town of Tomislavgrad had been repulsed. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vicory in Zagreb.
Beach Aircraft plans to lay off up to 180 workers. Officials say these layoffs come from slow sales of smaller airplanes. One official blamed the sales on the weak national economy and a 10% luxury tax. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 15 points to close at 3,249.11 on volume of some 188 million shares. This is NPR News. Only days before big primaries in New York State and Wisconsin, Democratic presidential hopeful Bill Clinton has strongly attacked Jerry Brown with questions about his commitment to Social Security and abortion rights. Clinton also accused Brown of distorting Clinton's record on civil rights and accused him of not telling the truth about his tax record as governor of California. President Bush was in Philadelphia this morning taking his election year campaign on the road and playing the role of Washington reformer. Doug Schlatter of member station WHYY has more.
The president spoke at Congress Hall, the site of the country's first legislature, and used the occasion to criticize Congress for failing to make the needed changes to streamline the federal government. According to Bush, Congress members are only interested in keeping the status quo and ensuring their political careers. The president spelled out a six-point plan he said would make Congress more responsive to voters, including term limits of 12 years for both the House and Senate. Bush also proposed shortening legislative sessions.
And I suggest that in the future, Congress and the administration work together to achieve a legislative schedule that allows members to spend more continuous time at home so that they can truly stay in touch with the people.
The president sought to capitalize on the recent congressional scandals to press for his package of changes. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Schlatter in Philadelphia.
In spite of having suspended his bid for the Democratic presidential nomination, Paul Tsongas' ads are appearing now on radio and television in New York State, 4 days before a primary election. A campaign spokesman said these ads are to remind people that Tsongas will still be on the New York State ballot. The head of the state Democratic Party says that the former Massachusetts senator is a factor who could win some delegates. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved down against other major foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Studs Terkel's art is getting people to tell the stories of their lives. In collecting their stories, he's revealed the larger story of American life. His books have uncovered memories of the Great Depression and World War II and reflected on how people feel about their work. Studs Terkel is also a familiar voice to many Americans. His nationally syndicated radio show originates in his hometown, Chicago. Before we ask him to talk about his own life, let's find out about his new book, Race, How Blacks and Whites Think and Feel About the American Obsession. In the introduction, Terkel writes about how people often speak in code when they talk about race. Here's a reading.
It was a slow day. The waitress and I were engaged in idle talk, weather, arthritis, and a whisper of local scandal. And she was large and genial, motherly. The neighborhood was an admixture of middle class and blue collar. On its periphery was an enclave of black families. And as I was leaving, she said, "Of course we're moving. You know why." It was an offhand remark, as casual as "see you around." You know why. Now, during the Boston school crisis some years ago, the leader of the fight against court-ordered busing proclaimed, "You know where I stand." You know where I stand. In Chicago, during the black mayor's first campaign, his white opponent's slogan was, "Before it's too late." Before it's too late. And then I ask, and that sets up the book, why were these people speaking in code? Why didn't the waitress tell us why? Where did the Boston mother stand? Why didn't the Chicago candidate tell us what it might be too late for? There was no need. All of us, black and white, know what it's about. Yet why the veiled language? And then it goes on.
Well, why do you think people use that veiled language?
Because deep down, this is my feeling, what I call the slender reed of hope. Even the most virulent of white racists, and I'm not denying there's a form of racism among blacks, we can come to that. It may not be. Perhaps it's something else. Because blacks, many would say, it can't be racism unless institutional racism as well. But back to the key aspect, which is attitudes of whites toward blacks, which more or less sets everything up, anyway, from the very beginning, 400 years ago. And there's a woman, I see some people I haven't seen for 25 years, revisit them. And this young woman, young mother, now middle-ish, defied the community, was an ethnic community, and they were afraid of blacks and anti, and she used to bring her friends in, and they were black all that. She defied them. She felt her kids should be more open than her mother and father were. But today, she's a little different. She does work that involves violations of laws. She's an investigator. And so she sees all people at their worst. But she says today she feels less sure or less sympathetic to blacks, still but less. And she, at the same time as she says that, I know I shouldn't feel that way. You know, I'm a good Christian woman, and I know this is a wrong feeling. So almost everyone adds that little caveat to what they're saying, or that little moderating phrase. It's what my feeling makes me uncomfortable. They know deep down there's something wrong with it. And that, to me, is a note of hope. It's not always the case, but it's there. I sense that. It's a recurring theme.
So, Sturgill, I'd like to talk with you a little bit about you. And forgive me if this will be a little bit contrived, but what I'd like to do is use the subjects that you've done books about and see how those subjects have affected you in your life. Let's start with Hard Times, your oral history of the Great Depression. How did your family do during the Depression?
Well, okay. We had a little hotel. It was a men's hotel in the heart of Chicago. Wells, I love the name, Wells Grand Hotel. And now I'm happy to see an SRO, a single room occupancy, a very nice place. I noticed that. We had a hard time. There was never a vacancy sign. Never. It was full. These were working men. I see a men's hotel, your first reaction is flophouse. It was the opposite. Back in the 20s, there were a lot of transient workmen and skilled craftsmen. They lived at this place. But then came the 30s. Then came the Depression, and bit by bit, we find the guys in the lobby. Then they start to drink some more, and there were fights breaking out. And bit by bit, they thought less of themselves. And then we had the vacancy sign. But we finally sold the hotel, not very much, but got along. And then I went to law school. Don't ask me why, but I did. I went because I dreamed of Clarence Darrow, and I woke up to Julius Hoffman. That's a Chicago joke. And he was the judge during the conspiracy trial. But I dreamed of, defending the underdog. That was the dream, And then I get torts and contracts, and I went crazy. So my dream was to have a civil service job 9 to 5. What better? A depression? Boy. And I did have a civil service job for 6 months, and again went crazy because I was counting baby bonds, which is a payoff to World War I vets. And came back to Chicago as part of a labor theater group for one. Was on the WPA, the Writers Project. That's how I learned to write. And then became, in the meantime, an actor in soap operas. I was the gangster.
Well, this is getting into the territory of your book of oral histories, Working. So let me ask you about work that you've done over the years. You started off in soap operas, and how did you start doing interviews?
Accidentally. I think living at the hotel played a role, just as a preface to it.
Oh, because there were all these strangers, and
yeah,
you had to learn how to talk to strangers.
It was delightful. I must say that my boyhood was a very delightful one. How could it not be? I was the one kid in the whole lobby, and these guys are talking, and I hear everything. So, but then I was disc jockey, and now I began to interview somebody, a folk singer, Maria Miranda, or Pete Seeger, Pete in his very younger days, or Woody Guthrie, Lead Belly. These are people I had on the program, I knew. And then from that, a woman once called and said, you should do more interviewing with people. I said, why? Well, because there's something, I don't know what, there's something different. Try it. So I did. And so went on to, one thing led to another, until finally I did stuff on this radio station, WFMT, where I've been for 40 years.
My guest is Studs Terkel. He has a new book of oral histories called Race. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Studs Terkel, and his new book of oral histories is called Race, How Blacks and Whites Think and Feel About the American Obsession. You had an oral history called The Good War about World War II. Were you ever in the military?
1 year stateside, nothing, called limited service. And I did in special services, meaning you write speeches for people and do entertainment, just a year here. So, but nonetheless, got an idea of the young GIs, the kids who were going and doing stuff.
What year was this?
1942 to 43.
So it was while World War II.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. The Good War. It's called, by the way, the adjective and the noun. I had that, in quotes. Because guys speak, I was in the Good War. Well, of course, in contrast to Vietnam. Anything is good, that is, tuberculosis is good in contrast to cancer, see. But The good wars were a reference to the war against fascism, of course. But the good and war don't match anyway, never does. Even that so-called good war is horrendous and makes savages of everyone who participates, no matter what side they're on.
Would you have been willing to fight in World War II?
Oh, yeah, I suppose. Oh, yeah. Strangely enough, I can even, this may be hindsight. Oh, sure. Because it was, remember, it was a dream. There was a dream of a better world. The New Deal was there. And then, of course, there was Hitler. And Mussolini was certainly Hitler. And I almost went to Spain in 1936. I was tempted. My mother and I had a big fight, to fight for the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, part of the International Brigade against fascism, Franco. And I almost went there. That would be 36.
I have a copy of your memoir, Talking to Myself, in front of me. This is from, I think, 1977. And you're standing on a city street smoking a cigar. Are you still smoking cigars?
Oh, yeah, but I have to do it privately now. And I respect, because it's a foul-smelling weed, and it's a vile habit, but I love it. But I do. But I got to close the doors now.
Well, who's stopping you?
No, I hear complaints from my colleagues, from my wife, of course, and from everybody. And they're right, because there is the... I do believe in that secondary catching of it, you know. And it's foul-smelling, let's face it.
You've been interviewed so much over the years. Have you been interviewed by journalists who you felt violated some of the ground rules that you follow when you interview somebody else?
Well, they don't try it on me. If they do, I just pay no attention. I don't. You mean like very personal stuff?
Yeah, because you have this thing about not violating, not trespassing on somebody's privacy.
I think that comes back to the Wells Grand Hotel again days. I just feel it. I'm no admirer of Clinton. I'm not, of his labor. But that has nothing to do with his personal life. I mean, I don't admire his anti-labor policies of the state of in Arkansas or is going down there to see a retarded guy executed. But the other stuff I find absolutely reprehensible. I mean, the going into it, as I did in the Gary Hart case. I find this... Remember the play, The Best Man by Gore Vidal?
No, I've never read it.
It dealt with two candidates for president. It was a good play. And one is a very enlightened guy who happens to have a mistress. He's married. But he's wonderful on social programs and humanity. The other guy is a wrong open, the year one genuflex before corrupt big boys and is a warlike guy, but is very faithful to his wife and goes to church every Sunday. Who's the best man? And so that should be the way of judging things to me. And so I find, coming back to the way I things I consider inviolate, as I do, I find this incredible.
So when a journalist asks you a question that you think is too personal, what do you say?
I just ignore it. I just say, no, I don't care to answer it. It's demeaning to you as well as to me, something in that vein.
And what kinds of questions would you say that to?
Well, very personal questions about... personal life, you know. That's about your sexual life or something like that. Something in that vein, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
Or a relationship to, let's say, my son or something like that. And I say, my son wants to live his life. He wants to be independent. And what's he do? I say what he does. Well, how come he's not doing what you're doing? Well, it's really none of your business. Something in that vein.
Mm-hmm. What do you consider to be the bravest thing you've ever done in your life? And I don't necessarily mean physically brave. It could be a decision that you made.
It's not brave. It's ego. The one when, I suppose, when the show was up for grabs, Studs Place. It was a very popular TV show, along with Garraway at Large and Cooker, Frey, and Ollie. The early days of TV, 1950, considered. It was called Chicago... It was called TV Chicago Style. And then came the McCarthy days, and my name was on many petitions that I signed. And many of those petitions, I'm sure, were begun by communists, you know, anti-Jim Crow, freedom of the Soviet Union, price control. And sure enough, I was on the list. And I was called in. They were going to drop Studs Place. It was a popular show. A guy came in from the network, NBC, I forget his name, to see me. They said, you know, you're a valuable property. I like that word, valuable property, but you're in trouble But all you have to do is to say you were duped. I was duped. I didn't mean to sign up, but these scoundrels duped me. And I said, well, I wasn't really, because I do. I am anti-Jim Crow. You know, I am anti-poll tax. I am for friendship with the Soviet Union, because this was signed during the war. But even then, I am for it. And so they said, yeah, but you could say the program will go off the air. I said, but I wasn't duped. And to this day, people say, Stud, you were so heroic to do it. They missed the whole point. Heroism had nothing to do with it. It was my ego. I think I'm pretty bright. I like myself. I hate to be considered a fool. And if I say I was duped, I'm just a goofball and a fool. I goof around a lot. But it was my, so I think it's my most egotistical act was that one, not most heroic.
You've described yourself as an atheist.
An atheist?
Yeah.
Well, I lean toward agnosticism, which, as you know, is a cowardly atheist. that's what I am.
Not willing to completely
I'm an atheist, but as I get older, I start thinking, hey, wait a minute. You know, that hourglass is thinning here. These vintage years, September song. Hold it, just a minute. I don't want to go yet. Just a minute. And so then atheism is slightly diluted. But I am, I'd say, an atheist, yeah.
So it sounds that maybe as you get older, you're hedging your bets a little bit on atheism.
I might be. I'm not going to deny that. But I think, what do I want? Do I want cremation? Possibly. What happens afterwards? That's it. Bye-bye, the little snowflake who falls down and says, hey, look at me, I'm melting. There's a little poem, I forget who wrote that, Walter de la Mare or someone, a little one. And that's it, the flake. You want just a little touch of immortality.
Studs Terkel, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Studs Terkel's new book is Race. It's published by the New Press. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Elaine Corey examines the notion of economic recovery this evening. Is it real or is it not? In political news, Elizabeth Arnold reports on the campaign styles of Bill Clinton and Jerry Brown. We'll delve into the intricacies of choosing a political campaign song. The Bill Clinton folks, for example, are thinking about Here Comes the Sun and about Paul Simon's Graceland. Neil Conan analyzes the legacy of the Persian Gulf War, a big plus for George Bush a year ago, but troubles with Iraq again seem to be on the rise, and it could become a significant issue. John McChesney analyzes the flat tax proposal put forth by Jerry Brown.
Thanks, Noah. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Ron Shelton, a screenwriter and former minor league baseball player, emerged with a bang in Hollywood when he wrote and directed the hit baseball movie Bull Durham. His next film, Blaze, about the relationship between a politician and a stripper, wasn't nearly as successful. But in White Men Can't Jump, Shelton returns to his home turf, sports, and the men who play them. Stephen Schiff has this review.
When you watch a Ron Shelton picture, you instantly feel something you've been missing at the movies. Good talk. Not highfalutin talk, not fancy poetic talk, not even profound enlightening talk, just dialogue that has rhythm and verve and wit. Dialogue whose idiosyncrasies reveal not someone sweating over a word processor, but the weird tilts of the characters themselves. On the face of it, White Men Can't Jump is about pickup basketball, the kind that goes on in public courts on city streets. But at heart, it's really about that brand of in-your-face insult and jive that's as much a part of street basketball as jump shots and slam dunks. Woody Harrelson plays Billy, a basketball hustler whose trick is simple. He stands around a court, looking goofy in his baggy shorts and his backward baseball cap. Goofy, and above all, white. How good can this guy be? Sidney, a terrific black ball player portrayed by Wesley Snipes, finds out the hard way by underestimating Billy and paying for it. Thus is born a terrific new con. Sidney will start a game with some tough black competitors in inner-city Los Angeles. He'll play so-so basketball, but his mouth will play at high speed, tossing off virtuoso taunts and brags. Now Billy will step onto the court and take a seat, looking supremely out of it. That's when Sidney, who's already maddened his opponents, will propose a bet.
I let you pick my teammate. How's that?
I don't believe this, man.
$500, baby, and you can pick anybody out here. Anybody. Anybody.
I don't believe this. I don't believe it.
The Raymond, man, look at the chump, man. Give him the chump.
Oh, no, 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 no. Hell no, no, no. See, white boys don't count. No, you have to give me a brother. No. You got him. The goofy-looking guy.
Me?
Yeah, you. You want to run?
You mean play basketball?
The scam works, not just for the ballplayers, but for the audience. Shelton may have begun as a writer, but he's a wonderful director with a loosey-goosey touch and a sure focus on his character's most revealing moments. Like Bull Durham, White Men Can't Jump has a peculiarly charmed atmosphere. Shelton throws away all the life-or-death big-game cliches of the sports movie to show us the pure pleasure these grown-up men take in playing a trivial game. And that mood of almost hedonistic warmth suffuses the whole movie. If you're a 30-ish basketball hustler, that means your life hasn't taken on much urgency. In fact, the only people in the movie who feel any urgency at all are the women. Sidney's tough wife, Rhonda, who's played by Tyra Farrell and whom we don't see enough of, and Billy's girlfriend, Gloria, played by Rosie Perez, whom we see a lot of, and it's still not enough. You may remember Perez for her role as Spike Lee's girlfriend in Do the Right Thing. She's a hilariously improbable creature with the body of Jessica Rabbit and the mouth of Two Live Crew. She turns out to be a fabulous comic actor, and so do Snipes and Harrelson. The symphony of juicy babble these three concoct has a subtext behind it. The movie constructs a brilliant contrast between the wordless physical communication two strangers can create on a basketball court and the frustrating impossibility of communication between black and white, male and female, when they have to resort to words. Where Shelton fails is in building a coherent, driving plot. But no matter. White Men Can't Jump is a very small-scale sports movie, and yet it effortlessly transcends its genre. It's also an awful lot of fun.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Next week, we'll hear from Ron Shelton, the writer and director of White Men Can't Jump. Fresh Air was produced today by Fred Landrell, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Sue Weinstein and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Larry Fishburne. He was the father in Boys in the Hood, but for years, Fishburne played the kid. He co-starred in a soap opera when he was 10, and when he was 15, he was the kid in Martin Sheen's boat in Apocalypse Now, a movie he thought would kill him. Now he's starring in the new movie Deep Cover. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.